And welcome back to Equal Time for Free Thought, a forum for better understanding the relationship between scientific naturalism and secular humanism, and how, when combined, they can inform progressive social change. My name is Barry Simon, and I'm joined today by co-host Matthew LeClaire. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Barry.
Today, we will explore a key intersection where these two philosophies meet. Science is most likely our best way of knowing and navigating our universe. It is a self-correcting method by which bias is filtered through research, experimentation, and via objective means so that we can get as close to truth as any human endeavor might. But science is also a human construct, so it can help being influenced by not only our own human brains, but by the cultures our species develop in which science operates. And while science is our best method of separating human bias from fact, there can often seem to be a very thin line between each of these. Today, we want to focus on a relatively new book called Merchants of Doubt by Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway. Oreskes is a professor of history and science studies at the University of California in San Diego, an adjunct professor of geosciences at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and an internationally renowned historian of science and an author. For the past decade, she has primarily been interested in the problem of anthropogenic climate change, and her most recent research projects include a completion of a book on the history of the Cold War and Cold War oceanography. Oreskes and Conway's book, Merchants of Doubt, focuses on how some scientists have, and still do, misuse and misrepresent science itself, for either ideological or economic reasons. In such grave areas such as concerning the effects of tobacco smoke on human health, the Star Wars missile defense program President Reagan championed, and the current concerns about global warming. Also joining us today will be Joel Covell, an American politician, academic, writer, and eco-socialist, a practicing psychiatrist and psychoanalyst. Until the mid-1980s, he has lectured in psychiatry, anthropology, political science, and communication studies. Covell is anti-capitalist and anti-globalization. He feels the rapid economic growth encouraged by globalization has caused our current ecological crisis. He argues that capitalism's expansion, quote-unquote, exposes ecosystems to pollutants, habitat destruction, and resource depletion. He is the author of the environmentally focused book, The Enemy of Nature, The End of Capitalism or the End of the World. Merchants of Doubt opens with a review of the notion of doubt, which is used as a wedge to get controversial, often unscientific ideas into the mainstream media and the general culture itself. Humanists and atheists who make up a large number of our listeners are familiar with this tactic because one of our pet peeves, if you will, is with the creationist community who, quote-unquote, teach the controversy methodology is central to how they plan on overturning the teaching of evolutionary theory in science classes throughout the country. Science is often understood as a method of inquiry where doubt is a virtue in the sense that it encourages experimentation and research to get closer to the truth. So, Naomi Oreskes, in your book with Eric, how do you see the use of the word doubt in the areas you talk about, and who are those who are fostering this doubt?
Well, it's exactly as you just said. Essentially, what these folks are doing is turning doubt on its head. So in normal scientific inquiry, in normal life, doubt, healthy skepticism, curiosity are good things. They're the things that drive scientific inquiry. So doubt and skepticism are essential to all scientific research, to all research in general. But what these folks do, and as you said, it's the same strategy that's used often in the discussions about evolution and creationism, is to kind of foster sort of malignant doubt, a kind of corrosive doubt that nothing, that we really don't know anything, that everything is uncertain, cherry-picking the data, nitpicking little tiny details that don't seem to fit in or misrepresenting information in order to create an impression that we really don't know, that the whole matter is really up for grabs, and therefore, well, in the case of creationism, the argument is that we should be, you know, quote, teaching the both sides or teaching the controversy because the scientific knowledge is insecure. And in the cases that we look at in our story, which is a whole set of different environmental issues, starting with tobacco and culminating in global warming, to argue that because we don't really know for sure, it wouldn't make any sense to take action on these issues like having an emissions trading system or a carbon tax.
Would you consider the quote-unquote science used by the people who foster this doubt, and we'll get into who they are and more details of your book in a minute. Would you consider this pseudoscience or junk science? And if so, how can ordinary Americans differentiate between junk or pseudoscience and a genuine article?
crucial question. So first of all, I don't use the phrase junk science or pseudoscience for two reasons, because this isn't any kind of science at all. It's not junk science, it's not pseudoscience, it's not bad science, it isn't science. It's really politics, and that's really the whole argument about this book. This is a political debate being dressed up as science, and it's being dressed up as science because most of us are interested in science. Most people are curious about science, and they want to learn about it, and if they think it's a scientific debate, then they have a very different reaction to it than they think it's a political debate. And so the whole argument of our book, what we try to explain in the book, this is not a scientific debate. This has never been a scientific debate. This debate was born political, and that's what we try to show in the book.
Can you expand, then, on the various ways these scientists or political operatives, as it may be, operate in their creation of what it really amounts to pseudo-information, false information, and how they've managed to...
Right, it's really disinformation.
Right, disinformation, exactly. And how they've managed to convince... you know, scores of Americans to doubt what most other scientists find plenty of evidence for. You can start here maybe with the tobacco industry and that story, which is the first in your book, because it's kind of where historically we find this beginning.
Exactly. So what we do in the book, really, and I think many listeners of your program will not be entirely shocked by the story we tell in the book, but it really explains it, and we think it explains it in a way that hasn't been explained before. So what we show in the book is that this entire story really begins with tobacco. It begins in the 1950s. In fact, it even begins on a specific day in 1953, when the scientific evidence regarding the harms of tobacco was becoming well known, and some fairly significant experiments had taken place, particularly one particular experiment, the Sloan Kettering Foundation, which was broadly taken to be a kind of definitive demonstration that tars in tobacco cause cancer in laboratory mice. And the tobacco industry was very, very upset by this work and realized that it was very, very damaging for them. And so they didn't know what to do. And so a group of tobacco executives met in New York City at the Plaza Hotel, where they didn't accept women in those days, and actually decided to engage in a project to challenge the scientific evidence, to fight science with science, and to claim that the science wasn't really settled, and therefore it would be inappropriate for government to tell our citizens whether or not we should smoke cigarettes. So it begins there, and then as we show in the book, it spreads. And a key part of the spread is the recruitment of scientists. So as I said, the story is not, it's not a scientific debate, but it does involve science, and it involves scientists. And so what the tobacco industry recognized early on was that the executives, vice presidents and CEOs and folks, they said that tobacco was good for us. Most of us wouldn't be so credulous as to believe that. But if they could recruit scientists to say it, then that would be a different matter. We as open-minded, sensible American people, we would want to hear what those scientists had to say. So in a sense, the strategy depends upon our open-mindedness as citizens. It depends on a good quality about Americans. We are generally open-minded people, and it exploits it. And it also exploits the credibility of journalists, because, again, journalists wouldn't be so stupid as to think that the president of Philip Morris, or the CEO of British American Tobacco, journalists wouldn't be so stupid as to think that those people were exactly objective.
Right.
But if a distinguished scientist said it, that would be a different matter. So a big part of the strategy was to recruit scientists to speak to the press, to speak to the American people. But the crucial thing, and this is, you know, you said, how's the sensible person to tell the difference? What we point out in the book is that if you just ask a simple question, what were these people actually experts in, what you see is that they were not actually cancer experts. In most cases, they weren't even medical doctors or biologists. One of the key people we track in our story was a famous solid-state physicist. So he'd never done research on tobacco. He'd never done research in epidemiology or oncology or public health. But the press didn't really ask any questions. They didn't dig. They didn't say, well, what do you actually know about cancer? What research have you actually done in this area? They just saw a man who was a distinguished scientist, who had scientific credentials, yeah, who had the letters PhD after his name, and they didn't really ask the follow-up question that they should have asked, which was, what was that PhD in?
Right. And this may seem like a fairly obvious question to a lot of people, but perhaps not. So do you know some of who these scientists were that were going on board with this, and also why they would choose to go along with these sort of imitation findings that really didn't really have good evidence to prove that, you know, it wasn't dangerous, but determined that anyway? Who were they, and why would they go along with this?
Yeah, well, oh yeah, we know who they are. I mean, that's in a sense, that was the whole point of the research we did, was
right,
to answer that question, to say, who were these people, and why did they do what they did?
Right.
And so, as you can imagine, our whole manuscript was read 3 times by a lawyer to make sure that everything we said was documented, was factual, you know, that it's all, everything is factual, and it's all documented with footnotes and documentary evidence. So the key people in the story were a group of scientists who had come to positions of power, prestige, influence during the Cold War, and in some cases even in World War II. And these were men who had worked on weapons and rocketry programs. So they'd worked on hydrogen bomb, they'd worked on the atomic bomb, they'd worked in the early years of the space program, they'd worked with the Navy on submarine acoustic detection during the Cold War. So they were very brilliant people, very successful. And because of the work they had done in World War II and the Cold War, they became very influential and served on many government policy advisory committees. And so these were men who, in some cases, were on first names basis with the President of the United States. So very powerful, very influential, and very smart. And one of them, a man by the name of Frederick Seitz, began work with the tobacco industry in the late 1970s. So they're scientists, so they know what science is. They know the difference between good science, bad science, or science at all. They are smart. So it's not credible that they don't understand the data. They understand the scientific peer review process, so they know the difference between true research and disinformation. So why would they do this? And the story we tell in the book is essentially a story about their own politics that were born in the Cold War. So what these men all have in common is they were all deeply, deeply communist. Anti-communist.
Right.
Deeply, deeply anti-communist. Very, very hawkish, very committed to a very powerful, muscular military and the role of science and technology in defending the United States against the communist threat. And I think it's fair to say that their whole identity as men, as individuals, was really tied to the belief that what they had done was crucial for protecting the United States from the Soviet threat, from the Red Menace. And I think they believe that authentically.
Yeah, even if the means going about it wasn't necessarily the best, you get the impression that they did it for a reason that they thought was good. They thought they were doing something for the public good.
Exactly, and that's in a way the only thing that can make sense of this story, because otherwise they just would be, they would just be evil. And I don't think it's not that simple. I mean, they end up doing things which are really disgraceful, but I think they understand it in their own minds in terms of, as you said, doing things for the public good. So protecting the public against the Red Threat. But what you see happening in this story is a strange twist right around the time that the Cold War ends. So in 1989, the Berlin Wall comes down, and these gentlemen are fairly mature by this point, and several of them are actually retired. So you might have thought that they'd just be happy that the West had won the Cold War and that what they had worked for had come to the conclusion that they themselves had hoped for. But they don't. It's like they're sort of addicted to the fight. They're like generals, can't put down their arms and keep fighting in the last war. They begin to attack environmentalists, who they accuse of being watermelons, green on the outside but red on the inside. They start seeing red under the beds in all of these different environmental movements. They start arguing that environmentalists are really socialist, that they're exaggerating the environmental threat for a political agenda, and that political agenda is to bring communism in through the back door, so that having won the Cold War, we would actually, in the long run, actually still lose through this backdoor mechanism of excessive government intervention, excess regulation. And that's the piece that kind of, once you get it, then you really get it. Then you see it everywhere. It took a while for Eric Conway and I to figure this piece of the story out. But once we started reading what some of these folks had written in conservative, libertarian, and right-wing locations, things like the Proceedings, the Journal of the Cato Institute, for example, you begin to see this language in a lot of places, and you begin to see this accusation. And now, you see it in politics all over the place. So just the other day, Newt Gingrich said that climate change is just the latest attempt by the left to control our lives.
Right.
So this idea that the left is really trying to control us, and these are just excuses to expand government control, it's that kind of Cold War anxiety that continues to run through this whole story right up to the present day.
Mm. Okay, I'd like to bring Joel Colvell, our other guest, into this conversation briefly. Joel, you have a lot of background, obviously, in understanding political ideology, particularly on the left. And one of the factors, obviously, Naomi is mentioning is that these cold warriors and the scientists who were brought into this argument found a way somehow to connect their anti-communism with tobacco smoke or supporting the liberty of the tobacco companies. And right up to today, with other environmental issues, specifically the ozone layer hole, which we'll discuss later, and acid rain, right up to global warming.
Yeah.
Also, I'm assuming Naomi hasn't mentioned this yet, but there was, I'm assuming, money involved as well and corporate benefits for these scientists. What's your take on this from the political aspect that you come from?
It's complex. I mean, everything Naomi said is quite fine with me. I haven't done the careful historical research, although Frederick Seitz is not an unknown name to me, and I should add that I'm a student of the political left, et cetera, but I also have a science and medicine background. My advanced degree is MD. I learned there, anybody who practices medicine knows that at some level, you always live in doubt. You know, like 90% of medical decisions are made, are educated guess. You don't have the complete set of facts before you, and you have to take the whole picture into mind. The presence of doubt in good science is not in itself a bad thing. I mean, it shows that the critical mind is working, and you're trying to. We're always a little bit in the dark about everything. But, of course, what you have in this case, and it's very, very significant that these chaps have a, I shudder to use the word defense, but that's what they call it, Defense Department background, and they've worked on the atomic bomb and so forth, produces a kind of a really pathological character who can be very sort of messianic, megalomaniacal, deal in these ultimate. And also there's this other element that they have, which is really subtle, and people have a little bit of trouble picking it up, and that's, I would say, the bad conscience that a lot of these people who are working in the big capitalist firms like Big Pharma, or more significantly in the oil industry, or specifically, of course, in the nuclear industry, they're taking steps that are really very, very dangerous for the world and for the future. And I think people in the nuclear power industry and in the nuclear weapons programs contributed to something which could bring about the very end of civilization and our species. When you embark on something that is so dicey and ambiguous, there's a tendency to reinforce your position by wanting to lash out at the enemy and then to justify everything you're doing by reference to a greater threat that creates a necessity for what you're doing.
Yeah.
It's not that these people feel guilty about what they've done, but there is a kind of an uneasiness which is then completely erased from their mind by going after the others, who are the people on the left, who are, in fact, genuinely doubting about what this country has done. Nothing exceeds the nuclear weapons program, you know, in the annals of human evil, actually, and we all know that, or should know that. And so, you know, we're dealing with these really, you know, these ultimate matters of life and death, very existentially troubling, and it breeds a certain kind of megalomania, you know, a false certainty. And they lash out at anybody who questions them. And then that's deeply reinforced by the big payoff, you know, the tremendous power that's their way.
Another topic discussed in Merchants of Doubt, and both of you can speak of this, I'd like Naomi to speak first, was President Reagan's Star Wars initiative, and here's where we get into the whole nuclear weapons. Naomi and Eric, you cite the founding of the Marshall Institute. Who founded this institute, and what was their role in creating the perceived consensus that Star Wars was anything other than a grossly ineffective and expensive blunder? Naomi?
So this is a crucial part of the story, is the role of this institute in Washington, D.C., called the George C. Marshall Institute. And three of the four key players in our story are the co-founders of this institute. And so that's Frederick Seitz, William Nuremberg, and Robert Jastrow, all physicists. And they create the Marshall Institute in 1984, a year that I find significant.
Remember that, yeah.
It's very Orwellian, because, you know, it's sort of like truth is falsehood, and right is left, and red is green, and all of that. So they create the Marshall Institute for a specific reason, and that's to defend Star Wars. So they had been serving together on an advisory panel to the Reagan administration. All three of these men had close links to the Reagan administration, and they were very pro-Star Wars for all of the reasons I just said before. They saw it, as, in a sense, as an extension of the Cold War defense of the United States against the Soviet threat. And they were really in the minority in the scientific community on that issue. As you guys may remember, many of our listeners know, Star Wars was opposed by the vast majority of American physicists and engineers. And over 6,500 American scientists had signed a petition organized by Hans Bethe, the Nobel laureate, and Carl Sagan to say that Star Wars was a bad idea, that it would be colossally expensive, that it probably wouldn't work, and worst of all, that it would be politically destabilizing because it actually might encourage the United States to think that we could be safe under missile shield and therefore we could launch a first strike. And as some people will recall, that there were people in the Reagan administration at that time defending the idea of a preemptive strike against the Soviet Union and talking about a winnable nuclear war.
Mm.
And that made a lot of scientists pretty uncomfortable, including very large numbers of people inside the weapons program. And this is the part that I think is so important to remember historically. The vast majority of people who worked in the weapons system did not support Star Wars because of this destabilizing component and because of the language that the Reagan administration was using about a winnable nuclear war, which no credible weapons scientist in their right mind would have really thought was plausible. So Jastrow, Nirenberg, and Seitz are really a very, very small minority in the scientific community, but they organized the Marshall Institute as a kind of clearinghouse for pro-Star Wars activities. So they organize workshops for congressional staffers. They have workshops for journalists in which they try to, quote, explain the science of strategic defense and explain how it could and should work in their view. And this is where they really come together, and this is where they begin to develop their strategies. But one of the key parts of it is that Seitz was at that time also working for the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. So these two different things come together. And Seitz was being paid for his work with the tobacco industry. So, you know, you said we haven't mentioned money yet. So we can bring money in. I mean, money is clearly playing a role here, no doubt about it. I mean, I think part of the reason this has been such a terrible issue is because there's a kind of toxic brew of passionate ideology.
Right.
And I think what Joel said a minute ago is exactly right, a kind of megalomania, a kind of belief that these people know better than everyone else,
right,
which I think is related to the work that they did on the atomic bomb, the hydrogen bomb.
Yeah.
So a kind of megalomania, kind of ideology, but then begins to come together with money. And so Seitz is being paid for the work he does with the tobacco industry, and he's learned a lot about the media. He's learned a lot about their media strategies and how they use doubt, which, as Joel said, is a normal part of scientific research, but how they use it in a corrosive way to undermine things that are really quite well known. And so it's this kind of confluence of the ideology, the politics, the money comes together over the debate over strategic defense.
Well, the media, I passed over that question. I was going to ask about that before because it opens up a whole different idea about how did the media get to be from a watchdog of our government and corporations to become part of.
I'm glad you brought that up because the media are a huge part of this.
Well, and Joel, I mean, well, how did our media get to the point when it becomes an apologist for corporate and governmental issues rather than, you know, they spend a lot more time covering these, you know, make-believe stories about Star Wars and about environmental issues.
Sure.
And they ignored Carl Sagan, as popular as he was at the time, his consistent arguments about, you know, nuclear winter and what would happen if we had a war, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Well, I mean, media is a huge subject, complex, fascinating, full of many interesting twists and turns. But, you know, basically, it's kind of a simple matter. It's, you know, the old adage of he who plays the piper calls the tune. The process, in this case, consists of the normal, I use the word normal with inverted commas, but still is normal workings of a capitalist system where, you know, there's a steady concentration of economic power, consolidation, and the forcing out of alternative positions. And the terrible fate of our media has many sides to it, as I just said, but the most important by far is in plain old class interest. It has to do with the constant invasion and encroachment of what had originally been an independent function with the giant corporations that themselves, A, are consolidating and forcing out competition, and B, as of course we all know or should know, are themselves deeply embedded in the nuclear industries and the weapons industries and the like. When NBC was taken over by General Electric and CBS by Westinghouse, well, you're talking now about the kiss of death for open and honest and truthful journalism. And unfortunately and unhappily, that process is inherent in the capitalist system. Happily, we have, you know, some awareness of that, and we are building alternative media systems, but they're alternatives to something that's very, very powerful and very, very malevolent, in my view. And we must never, you know, lose sight of the fact that that the big boys are relentlessly focused on one thing only, and that's the accumulation of capital and their bottom line. And that basic principle squeezes out alternative views, imposes a kind of a tyrannical, totalitarian view within the media system. And we're off to the races, and this is a terrible thing.
Yeah, right. And it's particularly odd to me that that they would be so against, you know, understanding climate change because, yeah, sure, maybe they'll be making a killing in the short run, but I'm sure that somewhere in their heads they have to understand that, you know, in the long term, this ain't going to last long, folks, you know? So,
somewhere's in their heads, but that somewhere gets shut down and overridden by the more powerful signals of the drive to accumulate wealth. That's the sad truth.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the ways that the media has been used, and one of the things that happens through the media, is what Naomi and Eric discuss in the book as developing counter-narratives. So, Naomi, maybe you can discuss a little bit about development of counter-narratives and how they helped convince millions of that actual scientific facts were, some result of either a combination of liberal bias or bad science or government tyranny, if you're talking about the libertarian right. There are some people in government and some people in the media do come out like Al Gore in regards to climate change, then they're demonized as, this is liberal science or this is Al Gore's personal vengeance against the right and so on and so forth. So could you speak a little bit about these counter-narratives?
Yeah, the counter-narrative is a really crucially important part of the story because it's partly how these alternatives are made to seem credible, both to ordinary people and even to honest journalists, because I think, although I certainly don't really disagree with what Joel said about the economic and financial interests, nevertheless, I think there's still a lot of journalists who are trying to be honest and trying to report as best they can. So one of the questions becomes, why do even honest and intelligent journalists sort of get sucked into this? And the counter-narrative is a huge part of the answer to that story. So it isn't just that these folks say, oh, tobacco is good for you. The strategy, in a sense, has two parts. The first part is the sowing the seeds of doubt. Convince people that we're not really sure about these issues, and therefore it would be premature to take action. But then the second part is to create an alternative story. And so the alternative story, which, again, it's the same story over and over again, is that these issues either don't really exist or maybe they exist, but they're not that big a deal. The left is exaggerating them because they want to justify increased government. They want to take over the government, and they want to control your lives, and they want to bring socialism in through the back door. We can't say that against Joel because we know he wants to bring it through the front door. So that's good. This is the counter narrative, right? And you see it in Charles Krauthammer, you see it in George Will, you see it in all these people, who are considered even to be credible spokespeople for more conservative views. And the consistency of the counter-narrative is partly what gives its force. I've been all over the United States and the world this last year talking to people on this issue, which has been really great because I get the opportunity to hear from people and understand. It's amazing how many people will say things like that to me. They'll even say, there might be a little bit of global warming, but the risk of global warming pales into insignificance compared to the risk of the government taking over our lives,
Right.
And so it taps into a lot of deeply held American anxieties about the role of government. It taps into the American belief that the best government is the one that governs least. It taps into American suspicion of taxation. And so you see all these old ideological issues, these old cultural anxieties being used to create this framework that then permits people to say, to ignore the science, to ignore the scientific evidence, to ignore the overwhelming data that we have that these issues are real, that climate change is really substantial, and fundamentally to ignore the most important piece of all, which I think Joel sort of was about to get to, that this is about a failure of the market system. And this is something that I think really needs to be on the table, and we say this towards the end of the book. Climate change is a market failure. Whether or not you believe that the entire capitalist system needs to be overturned, or whether you believe that, like any system, it has its limitations, and so therefore you have to figure out ways to address those limitations, it's a market failure. This is a consequence of the fact that we have a system that doesn't put a price on environmental value. It doesn't put a price on the value of the atmosphere, the oceans. It's what the economists call the negative externalities. But these are real costs, costs that we bear as people, costs that people in other countries bear, costs that are borne by other species, costs that come back to us in the form of ill health or environmental damages through floods and hurricanes and heat waves and droughts. So all of these are real costs, real things that are happening within the capitalist system, within the market-based system. And the capitalistic system, the market-based system, has not offer up an effective means to address these problems, to address these market failures. And that's the real question, that in a sense these people are trying to avoid. There's a really interesting book written by Richard Posner. It's called A Failure of Capitalism. And Posner is not a Marxist. In fact, he's not even a liberal. He's a pretty conservative guy. But he really takes this question on head on, and he says, this is a failure of capitalism, and we need to figure out what to do about it. And he's one of the few conservative thinkers in America who's been willing to pose the question that way. So I think he's a courageous man, because he's really cutting to the quick and getting at what the root of this whole question really is all about.
You mean the federal judge, Richard Posner?
Yeah, the federal judge, exactly.
He was a schoolmate of mine. We used to hang out together in the 50s.
Is that right? Oh,
yeah,
right.
we're members of a little collective called the John Dewey Society at Yale University.
Is that right? So was he a pragmatist?
Wow.
That's interesting.
He's a libertarian, actually, in many ways, but a very honorable and extremely smart fellow. He's somebody whose intellect is so strong that it can override his ideological position, which is not the case with a lot of others, you know.
I'm not the psychiatrist, but I mean, clearly there is a psychological component here.
Oh, yes.
That we have this major, major problem. It's causing huge cognitive dissonance for the defenders of capitalism. Mm. And so rather than address it and say, okay, well, how can we move forward, then instead they go into this massive denial.
Yeah.
There are two things I want to just foreground here, because everything Naomi said I agree with. I just want to add a couple of things. One is, I mean, as far as the individual capitalists are concerned, they're in a system where they themselves are the servants of capital. It's not just, you know, rational markets. They're the servants of something that's bigger than them all. And if they doubt it, if they step off the wheel, so to speak, they're perfectly free to do so. They'll get a golden parachute, and they'll be sent into retirement and any amount of money they ask for. And guess what? There's 100 or 1,000 bright young people who are in the wings waiting to take their place. It doesn't really mean that much if an individual or a small number of individual, you know, big businessmen begins to see the light, because they themselves will be forced out by the system, which is ultimately they serve, because it's a kind of a idolatry. It's like a false god, as it were. And the problem is there's another logic to it which overrides everything, and that is the imperative to expand. It has to keep growing or it collapses. And every capitalist learns that in the everyday conduct of his or her business. If you don't keep growing and growing, and the rate of profit doesn't keep increasing, you're in big trouble. And the basic logic is that there's one absolutely unquestionable value, and that is the imperative to expand. And, of course, that's the killer. That's what turns it into a basically cancerous system. And I just got back from Durban, South Africa, where I stood by in helpless rage to watch the United Nations COP17, you know, climate hearings, full of highly intelligent and mostly probably personally decent people who were totally powerless to stand in the path of this monster that is consuming the earth. It is an outrage on a level that's hard to grasp, because what's happening in the year coming up, in 2012, is that the Kyoto Protocols will actually expire. And everybody who follows this knows that the Kyoto Protocols were a big flop and weren't going anywhere. But at least they were an effort to do something, you know?
Yeah.
And now they're saying, well, we won't do anything for the next 5 years, and then we'll put something in and it'll take effect in 2020, which is extremely dubious. In other words, they want to wait another 8 years when, again, science is telling us that we don't have 8 years. We're ready. It's too late. But at least we can get going. And they chose to do nothing.
Hello, this is Noam Chomsky. You're listening to WBAI New York, your peace and justice radio station. It's hard to remember a time when it was more important to defend equal time for free thought. I hope you'll all join in doing so.
And welcome back to Equal Time for Free Thought. Joining us today is Naomi Oreskes, one of the authors of Merchants of Doubt, and Joel Covell. And joining me, of course, is our producer and fellow co-host today, Barry Seidman. And we're going to get back to talking here on this book. I just got out of high school just a couple of years ago, and I've had my own personal experiences in dealing with some of the stuff that I was taught there. And there's one book that I want to bring up, because it was something that I spent most of my senior year working on, and that was a book by James Q. Wilson, who is the head of the American Enterprise Institute, and John J. DiIulio, who was the head of George W. Bush's faith-based initiatives when it first started. And in that book, I remember reading it, there were some comments that talked about something like global climate change. And one of the actual things in the book was, scientists don't know how bad the greenhouse effect is, if it exists at all.
Yeah.
And and going further than that, to say that, you know, all of the scientists who refer to, matter of fact, I actually have it right here. It says that most scientists agree that the Earth has gotten a bit warmer over the past century, but from there on, profound disagreements exist. Activist scientists say that the Earth is getting warmer. Skeptical ones note that the Earth's atmosphere has been getting cooler. And the paragraph continues where they talk about the activist scientists versus the skeptical. And, you know, this is actually when I investigated this book and read more about it, I found out that this is the most widely used advanced placement American government textbook in the country. And so this is the kind of stuff that's not only you know, being pushed by the media, but inside of the public schools. And, you know, it was a consistent bias leading towards one direction. And it was the same sort of deal when it came to challenging or even considering the possibility that perhaps 100% capitalism is not the way to go. If, you know, in a public school, if somebody were to mention any notion of including any form of socialism or communism or taking any ideas from any other form of economic or political system, then it's immediately shut down. So it's something that is not only spread to, I guess we could say, adults, but it's, you know, it clearly starts from an early age. And what I find particularly disturbing is that we have people who I would think, we have so many people out there who I would think would pick up, like you both have, on these issues. But when it comes, when it's time to do something about it, it seems almost like we're stuck. We're in a position where there's only so much we can do. And I wish that there was a way that we could, you know, we could actually teach people what the truth is. But I guess people will, you know, take what they want to take and discard what they want to discard. But I just wonder if there's where can we go from here?
Well, you know, this program is, you know, is a good example of trying to speak truth to all this. And you just have to, at the least, you just have to expand programs like this and media like this to get the message out. I mean, my experience is that people are really beginning to have healthy doubts about the system now, because this ecological crisis is combined with this ferocious worldwide economic depression. It's beyond recession now.
Yeah, this is a very complicated issue, I think, and I think it's really good we're talking about it, because I think this is exactly right, that these issues have to get on the table, and we have to really confront what's really at stake here. So that section you just read is really scary, right? Because, I mean, in that just a few short sentences, he managed to say things that were both lies,
right?
And clearly historically, I mean, either they're lies or he has to be a complete idiot, because, I mean, the greenhouse effect, scientists have known there's a greenhouse effect since the 19th century, actually even the late 18th century.
Of course.
It goes back to Fourier, and if we didn't have a greenhouse effect, none of us would even be having this phone conversation today, because
right.
Without the greenhouse effect, this would be a frozen planet, and it would be like the moon, and there would be no life at all.
Of course.
So we know there's a greenhouse effect, we know the greenhouse effect has increased because of increased carbon dioxide. All of these things that are known, and the denial and the misrepresentation of the science is truly staggering. And I think it is important. I was just at the governor's conference here in California where Jerry Brown got up in public and said, you know, these people are in denial, this is disgraceful. And the fact that he would have the courage to say that in public is so great. I mean,
good for him.
You know, yeah, good for him. He's like one of the few politicians in America who's prepared to stand up in public and say there is a denial machine and they are misrepresenting the science. And this is not a matter of activist scientists. Nobody would say that Fourier was an activist or James Tyndall, who, you know, lived 150 years ago. Right? I mean, if this is a conspiracy, it started in Europe 200 years ago. So, you know, it is really important to say these things clearly and for people to understand the magnitude of what's involved in a misrepresentation of the science. But at the same time, this conversation also makes me slightly nervous, because some of the things that we're saying here today would be taken by people in the American Enterprise Institute as proof that they're right, that this is part of an attack on capitalism. My position on this is to say these issues need to be on the table. Climate change is not an attack on capitalism. Climate change is what's happening in the natural world. The scientists who have done this work, the vast majority of them had no political opinion about this question when they began the work. Some of them have become politicized, like Jim Hansen, by the failure of our system to deal with this issue. Jim Hansen started out as a pretty conservative guy from the Midwest, and it's really amazing to watch how he's been radicalized and angered by the way he's been treated by our society, by the way the science has been treated, by the denial, you know, both organized and disorganized. When Dave Keeling started measuring carbon dioxide in 1958, Dave Keeling was a Republican. He was a conservative. He didn't start measuring carbon dioxide because he was trying to overthrow capitalism. Quite the contrary, right? He started measuring carbon dioxide as part of the International Geophysical Year. But yet we've learned these things now. We have learned that there are these really serious consequences. So when I think about what it means politically, I almost think about it in the opposite way. It's really a question of, can we save capitalism? Can we find a way to solve this problem? Because if we can't solve it through the current system, then I think we are going to be looking at some very, very profound political and civil dislocations as people increasingly find themselves fighting over water resources as droughts and floods create environmental refugees. And it's not just me saying this. Nicholas Stern was a former chief economist of the World Bank, so again, not exactly a radical, but the Stern report is filled with a discussion of the possibility of tens or even hundreds of millions of environmental refugees. And one of the things that I find so ironic about the work that Eric Conway and I have done is that by denying this problem, by refusing to deal with it through liberal reforms and regulatory structures, which capitalism does have and has used successfully in the past, by refusing to do these modest things, we've actually increased the likelihood that we may ultimately need intrusive government or even dictatorial government. So the very thing that they were most afraid of, they've actually increased the likelihood that those things may happen.
But let me say, however, that there are two levels of discourse here. We should analytically distinguish them, even if we realize that they go together in the big picture. One level is the hard work that scientists have done to establish that there's a rising carbon of an anthropogenic nature is driving climate change.
Yes.
That's terribly important. That's the Al Gore's inconvenient truth. There's another level to this, though, which I did a rebuttal of Al Gore in 2007. It was probably the least distributed DVD ever in the history of media.
A really inconvenient truth.
A really inconvenient truth, okay?
Right.
So there's an inconvenient truth, which is that climate change is being driven by carbon accumulation. The really inconvenient truth is, could it be that we live in a system that must continually expand in order to survive? In other words, a fundamentally cancerous system. Now, in other words, that is pushing the carbon into the atmosphere. Now, you're quite right, Naomi. We must explore all these liberal alternatives and understand that we're facing some extremely grim prospects here. But this has been going on now for 20 years. I mean, I became aware of it in 1988, so for me it's 23 years. And
sure,
it's like you've given the system a whole generation to see what it can do, and guess what? It's done nothing. Now, the question is that because people haven't quite gotten the message, or because the system is set up to not regulate carbon in any kind of life-beneficial or rational way?
Yeah.
And that's a really, really inconvenient truth. Now, that has to be debated at the highest levels.
And I think that's great. I love the way you just put that, because I think that really is the question. And I don't think we know the answer. And I think you might be right. I mean, I feel the same way. There's something heartbreaking about this issue. I mean, I was not involved in this issue 25 years ago. And to go back and do the research and realize how much science was already known in 1988, that's why the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, was created.
Well,
and it's why we have the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was signed by President George H.W. Bush in 1992.
Yeah.
Most Americans either have forgotten or never knew that the United States is a signatory to the UN Framework Convention. So we've wasted 20 years. We've had 20 years when we knew about this problem, we understood it, and we had legally committed through an international treaty to act on it, and we didn't. So I do think that that supports Joel's pessimistic view that the system does not appear to be capable of dealing with this. But on the other hand, we also have the example of California, where we have enlightened leadership, and the meeting I was at just at, I heard Jerry Brown speak, and I also heard Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I have to say, I think that Arnold Schwarzenegger provided real leadership on this issue here in California. We have an emissions trading program that is coming into force in 10 days' time. It's a market-based mechanism. It's a capitalistic mechanism. And we are going to see whether or not this mechanism can work. And I believe there is evidence from history that it could work. We know that acid rain was not 100% controlled, but very largely reduced in the Midwest to an emissions trading system. We know that emissions trading was supported in the 1990s by Republicans and conservatives because it was a market-based mechanism, so it's a kind of political strategy that can bring together people from the right and the left. And we know that it was used in Southern California to control the nitrous oxide emissions associated with car pollution and successfully decrease smog in Los Angeles and Orange counties. So there are alternatives, and some of those alternatives have been shown to work, at least in some ways, in some cases. So I don't feel that we've entirely exhausted our options here.
Right.
And I think it's really important for people to know more about these options
and to think about it.
Well, I mean, that's a little upsetting to me that's going on in California right now. There are people on the left who are suing the state of California for not doing enough. And I think that's a tactical, political, and ethical mistake, because California is now doing more than any other state in the United States. And personally, I think it's important for us to support, you know, the politicians who are trying to do the right thing here, and the business leaders too, because business has played a very large role in what's happening here in California. It may not work. I certainly would totally respect Joel if he says he doesn't think it can work, but I also think it needs to be on the table for a serious discussion.
Oh, yeah. Joel, before you respond,
yes.
Naomi just put on the table a couple of different examples with nitrous oxide and other things that were done in California fighting SRA that were done through some sort of market ideology. And Al Gore's whole argument in Inconvenient Truth is that we can find at least initial ways to deal with this through market market means. What do you think of those examples she gave? Do you think it maybe does work on a limited level, and you're saying that it doesn't work on a larger level? Or what's your evidence that you've accumulated to say that there isn't really any way to deal with this, that capitalism really is reform-proof in the sense of doing the right thing within the amount of time that we may have before it gets really too late to turn back the clock?
Well, it's certainly a great question, and my views are, you know, are my views alone, but they're also increasingly other people's views. I mean, I arrived at this conclusion very simply. I was sort of pondering this growth of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. To me, it seemed to be an extension of the theory of imperialism, that you have the capitalist system leading to huge conglomerates and huge political entities that are constantly fighting over scarce resources and show no evidence of being able to cooperate. It's certainly the case that one could do very good things on a smaller level or a local level, and we should continually try to do that. What we need is a huge debate, and this gets to the subject of this program itself, which is how experts skew the debates in these matters so that nothing ever really important gets done. It is certainly clear that we have not seen any state leadership, any leadership at all in our society, which even wants to debate this question. I tried to get, at college I was teaching it, why don't we have a conference on is capitalism sustainable? And they not only laughed me out, they kicked me out. I was thrown out of a job. And
I think there were slightly more complications there due to the other work that you've been doing
No, that's true. But the attack against me started even before my book on Zionism was published.
Mm-hmm.
Really.
Yeah.
And I'm not pleading any kind of special omniscience here. I just want to say that we live in this grotesque system where, you know, every time there's a set of tornadoes or floods or something catastrophic is happening, and it's going to happen more and more, you know, the weather person gets up there on the TV and says, wow, the weather is really bad, you know. Never once are allowed to even discuss climate change in the national media.
But Joel, can I ask you a question about that? And I agree with you. I mean, I think the way the media covers, 2011 was a record-breaking year for weather-related disasters, almost all of which are consistent with the scientific predictions related to climate change. And I wouldn't say that no one has said that, but it is very rare. You're absolutely right that it's the unusual weathercaster, the unusual commentator who points out that these changes are consistent with the overall climate change that we're seeing. So I think you're right about that. But since you do have a background in psychology and psychiatry, I just wonder how much of that, I mean, there are certainly people who have very, very strong interests in defending the status quo, no doubt about it. But I also wonder how much of it on a personal level is a kind of more personal denial about confronting the limits to the way we live, because that's the other part that I experienced when I lecture on this issue. Americans don't want to hear a story that tells them that there's a problem with the way they live, even if it's not about capitalism and global, but even just on a personal level. So could you say something about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's what the Bush administration, 1 and 2, both said, you know, the American way of life is not negotiable. And, you know, it's larger than that. I argue, and other people too, that this is not just about climate. Even if we had a climate system under control, which we don't, and we're not about, we would still be facing catastrophic implications just from matters such as species loss or matters such as widespread and pollution of all sorts, the products of the system of our industrial society. The issue of the totality of our civilization is, to me, it's the greatest challenge in the 10,000 years that we have civilization. We're coming to a really crucial, critical turning point where if we don't take stock of the very basics and get back into the ways in which we produce and live, we are, I say, frankly, doomed. Now, just that notion itself is terrifying, but it also should be empowering and emboldening. If you can say, well, listen, We're up against it. Let's mobilize ourselves. Let's reinvent society, in effect. You know, 2011 was a terrible year for climate, but it was a fantastic year for social protest. I think it's a turning point year. These people who are occupying this and occupying that, and really all over the world, not just in the U.S., are basically saying there is something really wrong,
and
we're going to have to stop doing what we've been doing. It's an issue, the scope of which cannot be imagined, yet we need to imagine it. So I agree, this is a terrible crisis, but to me it's also very exciting. And when I go around speaking, I'm looking for the young people who are dropping out of the system because they don't have a future. You know, they're in six-figure debt by the time they finish college, and they have no jobs waiting for them and the like. Their houses are gone, and they say, all right, the system is basically broken. You've got to start all over, not all over again, not in any kind of radical, I mean, in a radical way, but not any kind of insane way where you just sort of tear everything down and build up from nothing.
Yeah.
But you've got to make this the single most important focus of our society and civilization.
What you're saying, Joel, I guess, in response, to what Naomi was asking you about California specific issues, is sort of she's counting on, and a lot of people are counting on, at least in the short term, something called political will, of our leadership having political will to make these changes across the planet.
No, I think
and you're saying, I think, that the political will is often, and if not the majority of it, is dictated by the capitalist system itself.
Yeah.
So whether somebody has the will to do something and the interest in doing something, and even maybe starts it somewhere, it often gets reversed elsewhere. I mean, I'm thinking about some of the things that Jimmy Carter put into you know, for solar energy and for the electric car and all the stuff in the late 70s, that Ronald Reagan just turned right around as soon as he got into office. So
he took down the solar panels.
Yeah, political will is too tentative. It's too easily manipulated, and it's manipulated that easily because it's not just about politics. It's about the economic system that we live those politics by, and that leads me to think that the real issue, as you said, in the most basic sense of when you mentioned what we've done for the last 10,000 years, is to figure out different ways to share our natural and human-made resources than we've been able to do through capitalism and the market system.
Especially on a global scale rather than local. You know, I shudder every time I think about there's so many people who talk about, you know, let's return to the time of the founders when everything was just on the local level.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, it's crazy because it seems like people just don't. A lot of those people do not seem to get it through their heads that you can't do things on that sort of local level anymore. Everything is global.
Well, but it also is local. That's the dialectic.
Both.
You can only do
something
immediately.
It's not just global. I mean, the whole global dimensions of climate change were what led people to look to the United Nations and to create the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change in the first place, thinking of this as a global problem. But, of course, you could argue that by focusing on the global governance aspect, they missed a lot of other opportunities that could have taken place, well, and in some cases did take place on the local and regional level. So
right.
I think it's really both. And, of course, you know, as we all know, if we've paid any attention to social movements, we know that what happens in the local level can be really powerful in creating models to show people that there are possibilities. And I suppose that's why, I mean, I admit to being a California partisan and being proud of my state, because, you know, Californians use 40% less energy than any other group of Americans, and we live a pretty nice life here. So I think it is possible to show that you can make significant changes. I mean, we essentially use half as much energy as the rest of you guys, you know, and it's not just because the climate's nice. Right?
Matt is ferociously looking that up right now, but to get some statistics on that.
But the point is that political will combined with good grassroots movements can make a difference. And
well,
so
maybe,
I think that's important. You
maybe
know,
rather than
we
thinking,
don't want to lose sight of that.
Maybe then rather than thinking about local versus global, maybe the terminology, Joel, would be centralized versus decentralized.
Well, no, I think I think we're all people of goodwill here, and this is a very friendly discussion. And
of course.
And it's fine, and I like it very much. But my choice of the key terms is eco-socialist versus barbarism.
that's not loaded.
Eco-socialism versus ecological collapse versus eco-catastrophe, okay? I can't, in the few minutes we have left, I'm not going to make a big pitch for that. I can only ask people to check a website that I'm working on with a group of colleagues, comrades. It's called ecosocialisthorizons.com. it has a lot of literature about this perspective and eco-socialist horizons. In Durban, there's a lot of interest. There's a lot of interest in the peripheral countries. People around the world are saying the capitalist system is collapsing, and we've got to think of a basic alternative. The fundamental distinction is that in an eco-socialist alternative, you're basically asking for human power to be freed, for people to be restored to their own capacities to transform nature rationally, which we have. But we're so oppressed by this tremendous weight of the capitalist state, of the capitalist media, of the, you know, the capitalist educational system, and so on and so forth, that people have lost hope and they lost faith in themselves. And that's the worst kind of doubt, you know, when you doubt in your own transformative power. And I think that what young people who are going to make the difference in this world, if anybody is going to make the difference, people who are coming to believe in themselves as genuinely transformative agents who are not slaves anymore to the system of capitalist accumulation, that's the radical moment that we're in my view.
Naomi, we're going to have to probably start wrapping this up. I wanted to get an impression of, having now written this book with Eric, what's your next move? Are you going to continue working on this with new material? Are you going to turn it into a documentary or something else to get the word out? Because a lot of people...
Yeah, well, actually, all of the above. We are actually talking to the documentary filmmaker, trying to get that moving. So watch the space. Hopefully, we'll have something to report on that in a few months' time. I mean, we have a few things going on. So I don't disagree with anything that been said here today, but I also, you know, feel strongly that it is important to think about. Let me just say, Eric Conway and I are not, we haven't given up hope either, and we're probably a little bit more optimistic about the potential for reforming capitalism than maybe some other folks are. And we're also a little bit more optimistic about the potential of technology to help make differences in the way we live. So we're doing some research on that, thinking about that. We're doing some research on the history of cap and trade to get a better sense about how effective it has or hasn't been, and whether or not that really is a meaningful mechanism or not. I have a great graduate student, Crystal Tribbett, who's doing her PhD on that right now. So we'll hopefully have a little bit more to say on that question in the next couple of years. We're just launching a new institute called the Climate Accountability Institute. That's going to be based in Colorado with some colleagues there. And thinking about the question of accountability, because I think that's also a really important piece of the story that Eric and I didn't really get at in the book. But in order to move forward, I think you need both a positive vision of what the future looks like, but I also think you need to call to account the people who've stood in the way. I think that recognizing the wrongs that the tobacco industry did to the American people were part of moving forward. It was important for the American people to know that they had been lied to by the tobacco industry, that the tobacco industry knew that their product was deadly and hid that information from us. And I think knowing that was actually empowering for a lot of people, knowing that tobacco really was addictive and it wasn't your fault if you had trouble quitting. It wasn't because you were a weak person. It was because you were actually addicted to an addictive drug. That was really empowering for people. So we think there's a similar story to be told about climate change. I've been talking with Matt Powell, who's one of the lead lawyers on the Kivalina case, which is a lawsuit in Alaska on behalf of a native village in Alaska that is now disappearing under the ocean because of sea level rise and storm surge. So we think it is important to ask hard questions about who's been responsible for this, how have their actions led to where we are today. And one of my hopes in the coming year is that the word Kivalina should become a household name in the United States. And so I'm working with some people to think about what kinds of strategies that we can use to make the American people more aware of what's really going on, not just with the science, but culturally and socially, and how we can use that to sort of break some of this logjam and move forward.
And what's the website for our listeners that you can go to keep up on your work?
The website on Merchants of Doubt is merchantsofdoubt.org.
Right.
And I'm working right now on a new website that will just probably be naomioreskes.org, but that's not up and running yet. So for now, merchantsofdoubt.org. And as soon as I get my new website, and we're going to have a website for the Climate Accountability Project too. As soon as we get that up and running, we'll have links on the Merchants of Doubt site.
Yeah, very good. And Joel, you're the website again?
Eco-Socialist Horizon. I'm embarrassed to say .com, but then we got trapped into that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. I was going to shut up for about a minute.
It's a
scandal.
You signed
a .org
and people said, are you an organization? I said, I'm not a company.
If you think about how rapidly stuff has changed, that now ideas are being advanced that were just faint glimmers or twitches, only a few years ago. And considering the fact that we're in a situation which objectively is of an exponential growing difficulty, I think we can look forward to much more widespread, shall we say, excitement or debate or commotion in the period ahead. And this is our fate. We have to make of it what we can.
Thank you, Naomi Oreskes and Joel Covell, for joining Equal Time for Free Thought today.
Okay, it's a great pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a very enjoyable conversation.
Yeah, here too. Have a good day.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Naomi Oreskes and Joe Covell on how some scientists, perhaps as part of a certain kind of society, have obscured the truth on many important issues from tobacco smoke to global warming. If you've missed any portion of this program, you can find it in our archive section at equaltimeforfreethought.org. Thanks to Michael O'Neill for his web support and to our guest today for appearing on the program, and to our engineer as well. Stay tuned next week for another Equal Time for Free Thought. And remember, till next time, tune in, pay it forward, and question everything.
Have I been sleeping? I've been so still, afraid of crumbling. Have I been careless, dismissing all the distant rumblings? Take me where I am supposed to be, to comprehend the things that I can't see. 'Cause I need to move, I need to wake up, I need to change, I need to shake up, I need to speak out. Something's got to break up. I've been asleep and I need to wake up now. And as a child, I danced like it was 1999. My dreams were wild. The promise of this new world would be mine. Now I am throwing off the carelessness of youth to listen to an inconvenient truth.